Good morning. Greet each one in Jesus' name. Good to be with you. I was human enough to think that if I could get somebody else to preach, the morning would have looked a little brighter, but I'll try to do the best I can. So, how many of you have something to write on? Okay, I'd like to throw a number of questions out there partway through the message, and I'm not going to answer them right today, but I'd like for you to answer them for me. So a bit of assignment for you there. So I'll try to tell you when I get to that point. Hopefully I will remember. You know, it's sort of fascinating me. In the last couple of weeks, I have been asking different people, like in different stages, ages, positions, for some advice on how to preach. And I tried to pick out what I thought was intelligent people for their sector and just see what they tell me on some things, since I felt my intelligence was a bit lacking. And anyway, it was just fascinated me in that when I was finishing up after I'd preached my last message in Pennsylvania, the older pastor there gets up, and he had quite a lot of things to say. But one of the things he said, forget the story and remember the point. And I thought maybe he thought I had overdone the stories a little bit. I didn't actually ask him. I decided to just let it. I get opposite counsel at home. I ask somebody what I should preach about, and they said, well, it don't really matter, just make sure it's interesting. And I think the thought was almost, don't forget the story, but it's okay if you forget the point. And, you know, just the variety of counsel I got was interesting. Some of this, I sort of put my own words. Somebody basically told me that in church or a Sunday, I look and act like a scary preacher. At least that's what I took out of what they said. And then somebody else told me that I'm not always sober enough. So anyways, it's interesting. I was trying to figure out how to reconcile this and help everybody hear God's word. And I'm not sure I'm big enough, so you could pray for me in that. And I don't say that with a critical spirit to anyone. It just fascinates me how we are. And one thing that they had in common that a couple people told me, they said, do not apologize for what you preach. And I thought, well, that's good. Maybe I do too much. Sometimes it feels a little bit arrogant or something to say that if you've shared a message before, to not say that you realize that, because some people will tell you if you don't realize it. So I might as well tell them, get that off the slate so that they can realize I did this intentionally. Other times I need a message, and so I don't always know how to reconcile, like I said, all that. This message this morning is specifically for me. In fact, I think I'm not trying to apologize. I think it's a bit repetitious because I have talked on a number of these things, maybe not in the distant past, not in this exact format. But I think it's something I need, and besides, it was assigned to me, and I'll explain a little bit of that as we go along. Okay, so bear with me. How much effort and or work does it take to get lost in the woods, let's say? Let's say you're in a big national park, you're taking a hike. How much effort does it take to get lost? Anyone been lost? I mean, like lost? How was it hard work?
Very little.
Very little. Okay, so basically, as long as you put one foot in front of the other, you're capable of getting lost. So, yeah, I don't know. Guess I never asked a person in a wheelchair if he ever got lost or not, but maybe that would save you from it. I've got almost lost. Thankfully, tracks around here aren't that big that if you walk long enough, you sooner or later get to a road or something you recognize. But just thinking of wilderness, you know, it doesn't take a lot of effort to get lost. Does it take more work, more effort not to get lost than it does to get lost? We've got pretty lazy, you know, as long as our cell phone battery's not dead anymore, we have it almost as easy. We just figure out where we are. But if we knock out GPS, it used to be a compass back. I can actually remember pre-GPS days. Imagine how old I must be. When you didn't just pull something out of your pocket and know immediately which 10 square feet of the Earth's surface you were in the vicinity of. And it used to intrigue me, compass. I remember as a little boy in Paraguay, Dad had this compass, and I thought he was sort of protective of it. Your magnets can mess them up. But it was sort of fun. You'd line that thing and think that, yeah, no matter what you did, that thing always pointed at the same place. That's sort of neat. But to use the compass actually took some effort. You had to get a waypoint to figure out which direction you went according to that waypoint and all that. So is it safe to say it takes continual effort and situational awareness to keep from getting lost. Now, I used that exact sentence in a message here a couple weeks ago. Did anybody remember that? Uh-oh, they're not remembering the point, so I guess I was overdoing the stories. That's fine. Maybe I'll remember it this time. Sort of changing tacks here. How do you feel about leaves? Do you like leaves, hate leaves, or just how do you feel about leaves? Do you have leaves? I've got some to spare. Bring a sack or a truck. I'll fill it up for you. Right now, we have lots and lots and lots of leaves. And I'm sorry, Stephen, I had totally forgot about your work bee till somebody reminded me late last night, and I didn't know if you'd want me bumping around there about 10 o'clock, so I just stayed home. And I was doing leaves at least part of that time. I mean, y'all are pretty quiet. Are leaves good or bad? I mean, what do you think about leaves? Okay, nicer in somebody else's yard than yours. Okay, well. Okay. So, have you thought about it? Leaves, at least as I worked with them yesterday, seemed a bit of a pain because I hadn't kept up with them and they sort of built up on me, right? Layer upon layer. And so, I had this mess to deal with. And in some ways, they seemed negative. I was thinking, if there's no leaves, there's no salad, right? If there's no leaves, I guess there's no trees, because finally the leaves feed the tree to some extent. And so we could keep going. So leaves have their use. And I'd like to think of leaves as an analogy. Can you have too many leaves? If you would have started out my yard yesterday morning, you would have said, yeah, absolutely. What happens? In some ways, I was tempted to let a few because my grass, such as it is, I have a rather poor yard, but it stays a little greener when the leaves cover it. But there was one spot when I got the leaves off of it, the grass was yellow. You know what that means? Grass gets yellow when it's not breathing well, it's smothered. And so too many leaves, you begin a smothering process. And if I just let that go on, actually I won't have any yard at all so far as grass, will I? I'll have a leaf pile, and that's what happens. If you just let, at least if you have enough trees. So keep that in mind. Leaves have their purpose, but they smother and kill. And I'd like to use as an analogy of something else as I move along. One other question for you. And I'm not intending for you to answer this to me, but I would like for you to answer it to yourself in a minute, but just hold on. The question is, are you covetous? Are you covetous? I don't think anybody that goes to church is ever covetous, right? We just don't go there. We don't do that. We're better than that. Especially if you stand up and preach, you could never be covetous. The problem is I am sometimes. But, before you answer that question for yourself, should we read Luke chapter 12? Why don't you open your Bibles? I have a couple references I'd like to give you. Luke chapter 12, verse 13. We have Christ, and somebody comes to him and makes a request. I don't know what you make of this fellow's request. In my mind, it wasn't that bad of a request, really. I want to try to put myself in his shoes. So Luke chapter 12, verse 13. And one of the company, so somebody that was listening to Jesus teach and preach here, comes up to him, and one of the company said unto him, Master, speak to my brother that he divide the inheritance with me. So is that a reasonable request? I don't know. I got to just pick on the Gingriches since there's two of them here for sure. I'm sure there's others. But let's say Sean came to Ernie and said, could you talk to Jason? Mom sold that farm and she was divvying it out. And he just won't let me have my share. Would that be a bad request, or should we say, well, I'll go fly a kite, Sean, that we don't have no time for your problems? It seems sort of reasonable, wouldn't it? Maybe we should go talk to Jason and help him. I know Jason would never do this, but I'm just, since he wouldn't preach for me this morning, I'll just use him. What would we do? Would we say that, well, Sean, he's supposed to forgive, and we'd have all that thing. At the same time, if a brother came and I knew that his brother wasn't sharing his inheritance like the parents had wanted and would say, I would almost think, well, maybe I should go talk to him. Yeah? Just give him a little nudge. Maybe we can get him the right road here. What did Christ say? Let's look at next verse 14. And he, Christ, said unto him, the man that asked this question, man, who made me a judge or a divider over you? And that seems strange coming from Christ, because sometimes he seemed fairly ready to judge, didn't he? I mean, go listen to what he told the Pharisees and things, and chasing people out of the temple. Don't you think they thought he was a divider? So sometimes he took this rule on himself. Why not here? Anyways, he goes on and somewhat answers this. And he said unto them, I guess he's talking to the crowd or the group now. And he said unto them, take heed and beware of covetousness. For a man's life consisteth not in the abundance of the things which he possesseth. That was intermediate verse, wasn't it? Thought of having y'all stand up and say it, but I got an intermediate person at home, so I might have to listen to that. So I'll just read it for you. But a man's life doesn't consist in the abundance of the things which he possesseth. Now, I get that, but he says, beware of covetousness. So he's saying, beware of wanting. I take covetousness as something that's not yours, right? But then he turns around and says that this stuff, what you have, isn't really what defines you. And yet, we are talking in the context of an inheritance. So if my parents let money and their will says that everybody is supposed to get such and such much, and the rest of my three big brothers would band together and say, "Ah, Joe, you didn't work near as hard in Paraguay as we did. We're making..." I used to listen to my brothers. Paraguay was an amazing torture chamber of work for them fellers. I just skipped out, and they can go on and on, and how strenuous it was, and how hard they worked, and how, the rest of us just have no clue of how it was. And so I could easily, I don't think my brother's this kind of fellas, but if they at all believe what they're saying, it would be very legitimate for them. The time of inheritance comes and they say, "Well, Joe, we won this fair and square. You don't have no share or divvy in this." And so if I have a problem with that, I'm covetous. Is that what he's saying? Sort of seems like it. So how's that work? Is it probably partially? How can I be covetous if something is rightfully, in my way of thinking, mine? Well, later on, I want to read a verse where it actually tells us that nothing we have is our own. So do you think if I'm willing to fight over something that is even legally, legitimately mine, that I still have a problem with covetousness? Have you ever thought about covetousness that way? I'll just give you another case in point. I had a lot of problems this week. I didn't talk as nice to my wife one time as I should have, and I was struggling with this one customer. So I don't know. Anyway, this one business, we did service work for them 2 or 3 times, and they haven't paid their bill, and I don't think they ever will. I'm not thinking they will. And I've been tangling with them, and I can't even get a response. But anyways, what I was going to say is the thing that sort of irritated me probably about these people the most was one day they called. I had all my day lined up. And he called, and they had a door that was messed up, and it needed to be fixed right now. Their trucks were stuck, and we had to come, and then we had to cancel. I mean, we've got to do whatever it takes. Okay. So I did it, and now they can't pay me. Come on, fellas. That's great, isn't it? Just mess up your whole day to help someone, and then they turn around and don't pay you. Somehow that just... the expression gets my goat, gets my something. So am I covetous if I struggle with those people for not paying their bill? Almost seems to me like I am. If I'm understanding what he's saying here, maybe you need to research that and see if I'm wrong. Okay, back on why this message. Do you remember the message I titled The Long Slide? I'd ask for help. Okay, so the reason I said that this one was assigned is I had covered the majority in the first one on thankfulness. This one's closely related, but I felt like it deserved maybe its own message. And the word that the person gave me that put me on this message is materialism. Materialism. Let's see, maybe I should just write that word up for me myself. It's sort of an interesting word, isn't it? So we have the word material, and then we tack this ism on it. So what is material? How would you define material?
Something
Anyone? Do what? Think. I don't know if it's Dutch, what it was. One time I got to the border crossing from the U.S. to Mexico, and he was asking me to declare everything I had bought. And I don't know, for some silly reason, I was trying to say fabric, and I said material. And you never saw a more flummoxed person. He didn't know if I was bringing Lowe's and Home Depot across the border or what. So material is anything physical, right? So my paper is material, the cup of water is material, clothes, vehicles, houses, whatever, material, physical things. Easy. So if you add an ism onto physical things, what do you have? Generally, if we say if you add an ism onto it, what does it mean? It means that that thing is a focus for this group of people, right? More or less. So let's define it this way. Materialism is a preoccupation. This is from Merriam-Webster's. A preoccupation, then I change it a little bit, and stress upon the material. Materialism. A preoccupation and a stress upon the material. So are you, or maybe I should say, am I materialistic? I think, again, it's a little bit like covetousness. We are all, if I would say, come and say, you're materialistic, you'd say, oh, no, Joe, I'm not. Well, that may be fine. You probably aren't. But I would probably say the same thing if you came and told me that. But the fact of the matter is that I am, right? I spend each and every day of my life dealing with material things. So how can I keep from being materialistic? I think there is some hope, but I think it's something everybody faces. So in considering a long slide, I just called this a long slide part two if you want a separate title for it. I called it, of what does my life consist? Of what does my life consist as a question? Yeah, I'd like to suggest to you that this thing of materialism is almost a foreign concept to North Americans, Christians included. It's almost a foreign concept. And I'm not saying it's better in another part of the world. I'm just going to deal with the part of the world that I live in. But you talk to people. Maybe somebody's asking you why you don't buy this or do that. And you say, well, not really sure if that fits into God's plan for me right now. And you see a blank look, even on Christians' faces. Should that be? Let that with you. That's one you can write down if you want. That's not the main ones I had. I don't think this should be as foreign to us as it is. I think we need to analyze this a bit more. So again, I want to thank all who helped. I will have at least two direct quotations more towards the end of the message that I want to read from brothers here. Before I get into, in thinking about materialism, there was one question that came from the previous message on thankfulness. Does contentment or thankfulness come first? Would you all tell me that? Do what? Okay. I tend to think of thankfulness as sort of the action of saying I appreciate it. So aren't you, if you're thankful, aren't you content? So can you still be covetous while you say I'm thankful? Well, I mean, you can do the verbal thing, but are you really heart thankful if you say that? I don't know. It's probably a foolish question. It was just one that came to my mind. I didn't know, so I thought maybe y'all knew. To some extent, I think a truly thankful heart comes out of contentment with where God has placed me. At the same time, I don't think I should wait to say thank you till I'm content, because that might be a long time some days because I struggle with it, right? Think about that. I think it goes hand in hand. They go together. So, back to Luke 12. Of what does your life consist? I'm going to change this a bit, and I've done this before, so bear with me. This is a new one. But the business of a certain Mennonite did very well. As the end of his fiscal year neared, he looked over his QuickBooks and took counsel with himself. What shall I do? My profit margin has, frankly, been very good this year, and I need some way to invest this, or I'll get hit with taxes. Wait, pay way too many taxes. So he consults with his accountant, and he comes up with a plan, and he says, I know, I'll buy some new equipment. I've been thinking about it anyway. And I'll also build a bigger building, add more storage and shop space. That'll help me protect my investments while increasing my net worth. If things continue like this, I'll retire. I'll let John take over as general manager. That will let me catch up on all the things I haven't had time for. while I was building this. I should have plenty to let me do what I want to the rest of my life. I don't know about you all. I mean, I know we find ourselves in different places in life, so I told you I'm going to direct this at myself, so I'll just put myself in there, was what I was trying to do by that one, no one else. But if I do that, what does God say about my plans? What does God say about my plans? Thou fool. That's not very fun to have God say thou fool about your plans, doesn't it? It's one thing if you say it because you can't do much about it, but if God says thou fool, I might not wake up the next morning the way it looks. Materialism, you know, it's such a sinister, and I definitely think it is part of the slide. I appreciate the thought there of, you know, nobody intends to be materialistic. I don't want to focus on that. Nobody wakes up in the morning and says, well, I'm going to be a materialistic person today. Well, of course not. But the end result is at the end of the day, some people could honestly say, well, Joe has been a materialistic person today, and that's true. Even though that wasn't my result, my goal in the morning, it was the result of my life. So how do I prevent that? Before I get any deeper into this, I'd like to say a struggle with materialism is not limited to the rich or the poor, the haves or the have-nots, those with a full wallet or those with an empty wallet. I would say every single person faces a battle with materialism. You agree with me? You know, too often I think we frame some of these things as someone else's problem, right? It's the person, generally the person who has more than I do is materialistic, or he's more tempted. Me, I'm fine. Not me. My checkbook's just, my account don't have enough in it. I couldn't be materialistic. But you? Well, yes, sir. Be wise for you to watch out. So we got to bring this back to myself. Am I aware of this battle, or is it a battle that's not even on my radar? You know, what's interesting is knew some people well that worked on barges, and they told me that those barges have a 12 to 15 foot propeller underneath them, and you don't really see that when you watch them churning up. You know something's going on, but and a lot of those have radar on. I knew they had it, but I wasn't quite sure why. And the reason for that radar is maybe there's a log stuck in the bottom of the river or something, and they come churning up there. If they can't see, in fishing we use radar to see fish, but they're not fishing. So if there's a log or something stuck, a rock maybe shifted, and they would have no idea on the depth, and they're not sure what's coming, they can run that 12-foot propeller or something. It can beat a lot of stuff up. In fact, one fellow there, he said they have a problem with deer trying to swim the river at one place in Kentucky. And he said that's not too rare that they'll actually suck a deer up in this propeller. And when it's a deer, he said it just makes a bloody mess. It doesn't do anything. Now, if you hit a big enough log or a big enough rock, it does. Maybe the barge will keep going, but its blades might be out of line or something. Not such a good thing. So they have that to see where they're going, even when they can't see with their eyes. So, you know, we can pretend that there's not rocks, that materialism isn't a thing to us, but finally it is. Do we have it on our radar, so to speak? And I want to make this personal, and I would encourage you to do the same. You know, we can always look at someone else, and so please bear with me in my foolishness here a bit. But I've noticed this in myself. Maybe I pray and hope you're much mature and wiser and don't do this foolishness. But, you know, I have seen in myself maybe a potential to build up that I'm concerned about somebody else, how much they have. Maybe their house is way big. It's like thinking in my heart, hey, brother, you really didn't need to be spending that much on your house. You don't have that many children at home. I mean, what are you trying to do? And so I sort of have this thing, and I start building a case out of it. You know, and I think, well, if I had the money they do, I sure wouldn't go where they did with it. But at the same time, guess what? Who just built an addition on their house. So just a little bit more, even though I don't go as far, you know, that's how we shift. I'll just use another one. Again, bear with me, my foolishness. But personally, when it comes to a personal vehicle to haul my family around in, I like GMC Yukon XLs much better than Suburbans. They're just nicer, I think. And they got the same good engine and transmission, right? But I just think they look nice, especially when they say Denali on them. They're really nice then, wow. And so I could just have one of those, but I don't have one because I I guess it comes back to money or planning or something. And, you know, so some other people here do. And so I could say, yeah, that's a pretty fancy rig. I really wonder if they need that fancy of a rig just to haul their family around. Because my Suburban is not, it's a little more. Anyway, you follow me? How you can start this process and try to focus on other people? And so maybe another thing, I heard this, and that was just said in Sunday school, so excuse me, brother, but I'm going to plow ahead with this one. We have these people that think, they don't like big business, and so a small business is better than a big business. That's the way to go. There's big business, you get too tied down, you're no longer free to move. Talked with a man a little younger than I am, actually, recently. It's in a business with three of his brothers, of course not in this area, and he said it take him, I don't know if he's extra fond of the church he's going to. He really doesn't care for the community, but he just can't leave because it take him 5 years to get out of the business he's in, just 5 years to get somebody else to take over. And so I can sit there and be like, yeah, you know, I'm free. I've got four great guys to work with. We just have this small business, and if I need to go somewhere, well, we'll just work it out. I'm not tied down like he is. I'm a little better. Let one of those four very important people in my life threaten to go do something else, and I can assume, how am I going to survive this? And I become all desperate, and I need to hire more help. I need to figure this out. Well, seriously? So small business is better than big business, but I need to make sure that my business doesn't suffer because maybe God's got a different plan than what I do. Is that consistent? That makes me think, and I've sort of laughed about this. Somebody we love very dearly gave us a sign that says, love grows best in small houses. And I had to laugh at that sign because they didn't exactly live in what I would have classified as a small house. I thought maybe they were just trying to encourage us to appreciate our house, which I appreciate their encouragement there. And so I thought, you know, that's so true. Love grows best in small houses unless I have money to build a big one, right? Then love grows best there. You follow how we work, how we're programmed, or at least me. I hope you're not weird. If you go home and you can honestly say Joe's weird, and I'm not, that's praise God for it, but that's how some of us work. We have these things and we like to point them at other people. Let me do this. I feel that for myself, too often financial convictions change with a change in my financial circumstances. You ever seen that in yourself? I'm not asking you to be weird like me. I'm just asking if you notice that. So you might at one, maybe you're just starting out. Maybe you don't even have any money. And you think, well, if it's mom and dad, let me have an allowance or keep some of my pay or however it works. And I have money. I'm going to save it. I'm going to do it right. Maybe you're newly married and you think you've got this figured out. And you know, you think, yeah, I've got convictions. The way we're doing it, the type of, as much as we spend a house, as much as we're willing to spend on furniture, however much we have for these hobbies, that's it. That's good. But let your circumstances change and you have some free money. What happens with the free money? It's like one of my best friends told me, he probably had at least up to a year or two ago had more free money than I did. And you know, he told me, he said, the pizza man gets it. I don't throw that at him at all. I'm just saying that's easy to happen, isn't it? If it's there, is that what happens to your money? Does a pizza man get it? Probably not for those of you that are living at home. Dad pays for the pizza and you get to do something else with yours. Sort of nice. Enjoy it. But do your financial convictions change with your change? I challenge you with that. If it does, I'm going to suggest to you that you're materialistic. I'm not saying that some things won't change, right? And I appreciate people that make it. In other words, if you would come and you would take it on debt and you would expect me to pay your debt so you could go buy another fishing pole, I'd say, like, you got some growing up to do, right? So I'm not saying that everything follows exact course. At the same time, do I have set perimeters or do I just go and my convictions change with it? Here's a couple I was reading in a book, and I know I've thought this before, but I'll just repeat it. As a test for myself on where my focus is what is the first thing I think about when starting my day? What is the first thing you think about when starting your day? And of course, I'm talking about when that alarm goes off and you have 5 minutes to think as you get out of bed, right? And I'm not talking about the time the baby yells so loud and you have to go right away. We know what you're thinking about then. But what's the first thing you think about when you start your day as you have opportunity? is the last thought on my mind as my day ends? What do I turn to, or where do I go in moments of danger? I think that's a big one. What do I turn to? Where do I go in moments of danger? What do I seek to save when there's a threat of loss? I think it was Conan Doyle in one of his stories. He says, a woman goes for her jewels and a man goes for his money. So I don't know what Mennonite ladies go for, but they don't have jewels, right? So you got something else you value. So I guess you're safe. For those of us over here, we still have to deal with money, right? So is that where we go? Maybe we built a big enough safe room, we don't need to worry about it. We can just run out of the house and go get it later. But what do I go when there's loss, a threat of danger and loss? Am I willing to say it is enough? Not only in the things I do not so much care for, but even in the things I intently desire and find useful. Have, in the last month, maybe is that too? I don't know, I don't want to give you too long. Day, week. Consider purchasing something that you absolutely had the money in your pocket for, and it would have been useful, it would have been right, there was nothing wrong with it, but you chose not to. And if you didn't, why was it? Just so that you could feel good about sitting on your $100 bill? Or did you do it for the kingdom of God to be built in your life? Am I willing to say it is enough? Not only in the things I don't care so much about, but even the things I would intensely desire and find useful. So I'm not saying we never buy things. That's not what I'm saying. But is there instances, fairly consistently instances in your life when you say, no, I have enough. I'm not going there. When, if ever, do I say I have reached the maximum of my ability to properly utilize what I have? So I'd like to look at quite a bit of scripture now while I ask the questions. These you're welcome to write down, but they're not the list I have for you yet. First of all, first two questions go together in the scripture answer. What did you bring with you? Two, what will you leave with? So what did you come when you were born? What did you bring? When you die, what will you go with? Maybe just listen to the first two. Job chapter 1, verse 20 and 21. Job, after all his loss, says, then Job arose, rent his mantle, shaved his head, fell down on the ground and worshipped and said, naked came I out of my mother's womb, and naked shall I return thither, he means to the ground. And the Lord gave and the Lord hath taken away. Blessed be the name of the Lord. You know, as you're working day by day with these material things, do you each and every day and multiple times a day realize that you came with nothing so far as material and you will leave with nothing? If you're forgetting that, if I forget it, I'm in danger. I came with nothing and I'm going to leave with nothing. Psalm 49, verse 16 to 19. Be not thou afraid when one is made rich. Listen to this. Don't worry about it. When the glory of his house is increased, when he's really looking like something, for when he dieth, he shall carry nothing away. His glory shall not descend after him. In other words, what he looks to be, the acclamation, the praise, the glory that he seems to have for having achieved the American dream, shall we say, doesn't go with him. It stays here. He's nothing. And it says, though while he lived, he blessed his soul. In other words, he did what made him happy. And then it's sort of in parentheses in my mind says, men will praise thee when thou doest well to thyself. In other words, if you see me buy a new truck, buy a new boat, and fill it with the rods that I want, and you see me say, well, you'll talk good about me. That's what it says, right? Wish I could do that. Men will talk well when thou doest well to thyself. But it says, he shall go to the generation of his fathers, anyways, to the grave. They shall never see light. It ends. Darkness. So, what do I come with? What can I take with me when I leave? Third question. If this is right, if what scripture telling us is right, that we come with nothing, we go with nothing, what is the effect of having more than food and raiment, more than the necessaries? Again, if you want to turn to it, you may, or you can just listen. Chapter 5, verse 9 through 16. Ecclesiastes 5, verse 9. Maybe the verse 9 is a little bit of a strange verse to start with, but it says, moreover, the prophet of the earth is for all. The king himself is served by the field. So I guess he's saying that no matter how far you get in life, no matter how great you are financially, even if you're a king, you're served by the simple things in life, right? If you don't have any farmers, there's nothing to eat, basically. So we all start there. Then he goes on, he says, he that loveth silver shall not be satisfied with silver, nor he that loveth abundance with increase. You like high interest? Well, you won't be satisfied with that either. He says, this is also vanity. Then notice what he says, verse 11. When goods increase, material possessions, when they increase, they are increased that eat them. Shall we put that into 2021 phraseology? It means that if, as inflation soars and I need to have a profit margin, that finally I need to hire more people to get my profit higher, that finally I'm going to be paying more people, the end result may be that I have nothing more than what I started out with. That's what he's saying, right? As goods increase, they are increased that eat them. So if I have 100 sheep, I don't know, Johnny, can Tala take care of 100 sheep? But let's say you can, I don't know. Let's say you take care of 100 sheep and like, well, this is just barely working. So I get 150 sheep, but I just can't keep up here. These dogs help, but I finally need somebody else. So I hire somebody. Then, well, all of a sudden I lost the profit of my 50 sheep, so I have to get another 50. And now we're both back to where we were, right? And especially in business, you're surprised how often that works out. I'm not saying always, but there's some truth to that one. And then he goes on and says, what good is there to the owners thereof? Except here's the good. And I just love that he put this in here. Solomon, think about it. He knew a lot more about profit margin than I did. He said, saving the beholding them with their eyes. Okay? So let me again put that in 2021 phraseology. Basically, he's saying that as your goods increase, your expenses increase. So he says, what's the benefit in all this? Well, he says, finally, at the end of the day, it's that warm, cozy feeling you get looking at a bigger number in QuickBooks. Okay, especially true when you are already adequately clothed and fed with what you have. 12, the sleep of the laboring man is sweet. This is talking about a man that does his own work, gets up in the morning, knows how to sweat, isn't just looking at the QuickBooks. Whether he eat little or much, he's going to be able to sleep because he's wore out. You know, in fact, one of the primary things, and maybe I need to practice this more myself, but you find somebody, let's just say a young man that's really struggling in an area in his life, one thing that's important is that when you get to the end of the day that you are physically tired and mentally tired. And if you have an overly physical job, maybe you need to do study for a topic, even if you don't have one, so that you get mentally tired. If your work is more mental, you need to do something physical, go run a mile or two. The sleep of the laboring man is sweet, whether he eat little or much, but the abundance of the rich will not suffer him to sleep. True. Try it. Solomon ought to know, right? He had a lot more than I ever will. So if he said it, I'm pretty foolish to think I have to replicate Solomon to believe it, because I won't get there in this life. So I guess I'm going to try to accept that one. The abundance of the rich will not suffer him to sleep. 13, there is a sore evil which I have seen under the sun, namely, riches kept for the owners thereof due to their hurt. There is a sore evil which I have seen under the sun, namely, riches kept for the owners thereof to their hurt. Now, that verse has been a challenge to me, and I'll tell you my philosophy. Maybe you're going to think I'm a socialist, and I'm not trying to get into the government at all. But as I read that verse, I think many times we read that verse, we think that through cheating or something. I would say to me, this goes beyond just dishonesty. If I am getting rich, if I'm really doing well off of somebody else's effort, and I just keep that to myself, I think it's going to hurt me. That's what I think. Personally, I'm not saying I've done a super job on this, but I'll just tell you my goal is I really think that the people that work for me should be able to live on the same level of lifestyle that I do. Otherwise, I think I'm keeping something to myself that's going to hurt me in the end. I'll let you split that for yourself. Just my thought. And he goes on, but he says, the riches that you keep, however you want to say that, but to me, if I would be just getting rich and I'd be paying as little as I could for help, those riches that are gotten, accomplished in that way, those riches perish by evil travail or through bad experience. And he says, and he begetteth a son, and there is nothing in his hand. In other words, if I'm going to enrich myself at the expense of others and not share that with them, it's fairly certain that if I have a son, which I don't, if he were to come along, there would be nothing for him. Because I was unwilling to pass on what was legitimately deserved. Verse 15, as he came forth of his mother's womb, naked shall he return to go as he came, and shall take nothing of his labor which he may carry away in his hand. You know, I've seen people buried with stuff, but it's interesting. The big farmer that was buried with his stuff actually had a toy tractor rather than the big tractor in the coffin. Isn't it? So we, even those people know they can't take it, even though I guess they get some sort of feeling out of putting it there. 16, and this also is a sore evil, that in all points as he came, so shall he go, and what profit hath he that hath labored for the wind? You know, if I was to go out here and, I don't know, maybe buy a couple acres off Daniel where the wind blows over his hill pretty good, and I'd put me a level spot and build me a great big shed and put the biggest doors in I could, and I'd wait till a real windy day, and I'd say, I'm going to catch the wind in here, fellas, and that wind would come, and I'd slam them doors shut. I got the wind. You think, well, he's pretty kooky. He's got some screws loose, and I don't know if he should be preaching. But he's saying the person that just tries to accumulate for himself is doing the exact same thing, trying to hoard the wind in the shed. Okay, so the question four that I want to answer out of Bible now, is there danger in having a lot of things? And I think every last one of us falls in this category. Is there danger in having a lot of things? And what's strange to me is we live in a funny culture where even the poorest people have a lot of things. Go drive some of these back roads, or not even the back roads. You know, look at people that, if you go to the poor, if you try to find a poor person in the U.S., you probably go to the person that has a lot of stuff in their yard, right? They got a lot of things. They may not be worth anything, but they got a lot of things. So I think this goes for us all. So Proverbs 30, chapter 30, verse 8 and 9. A prayer, I take it. It says, remove far from me vanity and lies. Vanity to me is worthlessness, pride. And lies means deception. So remove far from me pride and deception. Then he says, give me neither poverty nor riches. Feed me with food convenient for me, lest I be full and deny thee. He's saying that's the problem. When you have too much, you become full and you deny. Now, I would hesitate to say that any of us here, when we become full, we deny God as in our speech, but by our actions, we deny him. We start needing to trust in something else. Needing more insurance. Thinking maybe I should have life insurance because my business has grown to this point. Those are all ways I feel that we deny Christ rather than trusting in him. We become full. And when you're full, you actually need more assurance rather than less assurance to safeguard your fullness. Lest I be full and deny thee and say, who is the Lord? Or lest I be poor and steal and take the name of the God in vain. So when you have nothing to eat and you go start stealing bread and you get caught, then it's easy to, well, now you got problems. So he says, don't give me any of those. Just give me food convenient for me. So absolutely you can have too much. Well, then how should I then live? 1 Corinthians chapter 7, verse 29 through 31. How should I then live if I can have, if you can collect too much in this life, what should I do? 1 Corinthians chapter 7, 29. But this I say, brethren, the time is short. It remaineth that both they that have wives be as though they had none. So he starts out with the wife, but he doesn't end there. He says, whether you're married or single, a time is coming when it won't be a difference. And they that weep as though they wept not. So whether you're crying or laughing, there's a time coming when that won't make any difference. And they that rejoice as though they rejoice not. And they that buy as though they possess not. And they that use this world as not abusing it, for the fashion or the things of this world passeth away. The phrase that really stood out to me in those verses is those that use this world as not abusing it. So I looked up the word use. It's to use, actually, in Strong's, you check me up on this, means to furnish what is needed. So it's okay to have enough food for you to get home, when you get home to eat. I think it's fine to have a place to call home, a roof over your head. To use, but the word use, if I was to use a different word, actually means to graze. To graze. Now, you know what a cow grazes? Do they roll up a big ball of grass and then stand around and chew on it? No, they eat what they need right then, right? And if there's going to be hay for a cow to eat, the farmer actually has to go the process of making it. The cow doesn't do it. So graze. And as I see graze, I think that's what, in some way, what God expects of us. It's not saying that we are to starve ourselves, that we're not to have adequate clothing, but we're to graze, to use what's needed for the time, but let trust God with beyond that. Then the other word is abuse. That word, interesting, we have our own definition, but Strong's would just merely say overuse or misuse, just to do too much. If you eat too much, maybe you have abused this world. And I've done that, haven't I? Overuse or misuse. So think about that. They that use, using what's available, but not becoming attached, not hoarding it. 1 Corinthians chapter 6, verse 19, 20 says this. What? Know ye not that your body is the temple of the Holy Ghost, which is in you, which ye have of God, and ye are not your own. I referred to that at the beginning. Ye are not your own, for ye are bought with a price. Therefore glorify God in your body and in your spirit, which are God's. So you know, whatever I have, if my body and if my spirit are God's, how much more the clothes I wear, the vehicle I drive, the house I live in. If my body is to be, of course, anything that relates to that body needs to be. Some of you are looking sleepy. Go ahead and stand up, all of you. I figure they want company. 1 Timothy chapter 6, verse 6. Read a couple more verses. 1 Timothy 6, verse 6. But godliness with contentment is great gain. For we brought nothing into this world, and it is certain we can carry nothing out. Then he says, actually says this, Paul said this, can you believe it? He didn't know better. And having food and raiment, let us therewith be content. Poor Paul, if he had only known how great it was just to have a Suburban, he would have forgot the Yukon XL, right? Having food and raiment, let us therewith be content. Again, I am not trying to say, I don't want you to leave here and say, oh, Joe was saying we should, not necessarily. But am I grazing? Am I just using what God? If God has a Suburban for me, do I use that Suburban? If he's got a Yukon XL for you, well, praise him. Use that. But it's not a right. Having food and raiment, let us therewith be content. Enough to survive. You need to be happy there. Whew. You know, if you have more than just enough to survive, then I will suggest to you that you have the desire mentioned in this next verse. I think we all have it. What are you doing about it? Verse 9. But they that will be rich fall into temptation and a snare, and many foolish and hurtful lusts, which drown men in destruction and perdition. You know, it's so easy. Foolish and hurtful lusts. And for me, the temptation isn't maybe to go stroll down the mall and look at the purses and the shoes and all that. That maybe I go online and research this piece of equipment or that thing, right? Foolish and hurtful lusts. Which drown men in destruction and perdition. For the love, the desire for and of money is the root of much evil. Which while some coveted after, they have erred from the faith and have pierced them through with many sorrows. And again, please think of covetousness not so much as merely wanting, I want Vernon's Ford Edge, as that even if something's legitimately mine, I hang on to it. Going back to that thing of using is not abusing, another thing Strong said was to touch lightly. And to me, it's the difference. You know how a child hanging on to a toy, mine, mine, versus just touch it lightly. Yeah, it's here. It's to be used, but I can't hang on to it. Okay, you can sit back down if you can stay awake. Going on, Philippians 4, verse 11 through 13. Philippians 4, verse 11. Paul, talking to the Philippian church, thanking them for sharing, says, not that I speak in respect to want, for I have learned in whatsoever state I am therewith to be content. I think that's the key, is do you know how to be content right where you are? If you're not content with what you have now, even if I could have the ability to write you a $1 million check, you would not be content very long. Contentment is more based on who I am and how I relate to my circumstances than it is my actual circumstances. I know both how to be abased, to have nothing, be in need. I know how to abound, have more than enough. Paul says he knows how that is, to have a Yukon XL. Think about that. Everywhere and in all things I am instructed both to be full and to be hungry, both to abound and to suffer need. He says, I can handle all these, and this is how I can do all things through Christ, which strengtheneth me. You know, if Christ is the focus, whether I barely have enough for lunch, or whether I've got enough lunch for 1,000 Sundays, I can only handle either one of those problems if Christ is in me, strengthening me. Hebrews 13, I'm almost at the end here. Hebrews 13, verse 5 and 6 says this, "Let your conversation be without covetousness." Oh, that word again. "Not desirous even of that which is legitimately mine. And be content with such things as ye have. For he hath said, I will never leave thee nor forsake thee." You know, in other words, he's telling me if I'm not content with right where I'm at right now, with the circumstances I'm in, it's a problem in my heart with my walk with God. Notice that? Let me read that again. "For let your conversation be without covetousness, and be content with such things as ye have. For he," Christ, "has said, I will never leave thee nor forsake thee." If we have Christ and we're not content, we've got a problem. What more may a Christian want? "So that," or because of this, "we may boldly say, the Lord is my helper. I will not fear what man shall do unto me." Whether it's a lawsuit, whether it's a brother that doesn't share. Okay, here are my list of questions. You ready to write? And I can't answer these, so that's why I just give you questions. I can ask them to myself, and I can ask God to help me, but I don't know. That's as far as I can go. How much does it take to have enough? How much does it take to have enough? Is that dollars? Is that cows? Is that vehicles? Is that guns? Is that fishing pools? How much does it take to have enough? Second one is, how can I know when I have too much? How can I know when I have too much? Do I just keep buying things till somebody else comes and tells me? Is God going to come thunder from heaven? How do I know when I have too much? So the next one's building very closely on that, just for myself. What are some signs I have too much? Maybe this is easier to see in someone else. So here, do it for me. Please, if you have a list, get it together and hand it to me. What are some signs that Joe has too much of whatever? Go ahead, tell me. Be glad for your thoughts. The fourth one, there's nine of them. We're getting there. How much can I have before it becomes a distraction? How much can I have before it becomes a distraction? Thinking, of course, in the Christian life. And of course, I would say it absolutely varies, doesn't it? But I'm talking of myself. The next one, five, how much can I have before I begin to trust in it? You know, you can have, I think a fellow could have a dollar, which isn't very much, and you could trust in the dollar, right? So where's that threshold for you? How much can I have before I begin to trust in it? So I know some of these are almost repetitious, but what are some signs I trust in what I have? What are some signs I trust in what I have? Getting there, I'm not sure. I'm probably going too fast. If I do, just get with me after church, or I can text or email them. How much may I protect what I have? How much may I protect what I have? And this could be from buying insurance to standing outside my house with a gun. Eight, how much do I need to share? In other words, as a good Christian wanting to be right with God, what percentage or what to what extent do I need to share what I have? And then the last one, where do I turn in moments of danger and loss? And I asked that already, didn't I? But where do I turn in moments of danger and loss? Again, I think, I don't know, just my opinion in looking over history, there's been no issue that so much showed our hearts to ourselves, possibly, as finances. And I think technology maybe today is bringing out what finances would have shown all along if we would have known. But it's a little bit more, it's a little bit hard. We can't put a filter on your wallet that reports to everyone when you open it and what you put on your credit card, and it's probably just good. I'm not suggesting we should. But at the same time, I would say that there's very close parallels, that the way I spend my money, the way I relate to finances, wherever I find myself, is a real glimpse into my heart, just as is my technology use. They run very close, and they're very similar in a lot of ways if you stop and think about it. Okay, to wrap this up, I'd like to talk about the exponential increase problem. Can anybody tell me what exponential means? Exponential. It means that, okay, if I have just an addition, right? I got 11. Exponential is like when I have 10 and I multiply by 10. Now I got 100. That was increase, you know? Okay. How many of you remember the story I told on the last message, those of you that were here, about thankfulness, about the man on the sled? Remember that? Somebody told me they never expect to hear that story of the pulpit, so I don't know if I should apologize or not, but I'm going to talk about it again because it worked. They evidently remembered the story, at least. So, you know, when he started down that trail, and he's like, boys, this thing isn't even steep enough to give you a decent ride. Person starting out with finances. They're there, working hard, and like, this isn't going anywhere. This doesn't give me a decent ride. And, you know, I've found it, and I've witnessed this in other people. So you work hard, and you're clawing at the grass, dirt, trying to get this old sled going a little faster, and it just barely moves. You remember what happened to him after he went around the curve? He hollered, didn't he? He hollered, the little boy looks at the other little boy and says, I think he liked that part of the trail, didn't he? And, you know, that's what I call exponential increase is, so we work so hard, we come programmed, and he said, I'd like to give more to God's work in various ways, but he said, I'm digging so hard to keep the sled moving that I just don't have time right now. But his thought was that once the sled's moving, I'll do it. Well, guess what happens? Is just as that fellow came to the steep part in the trail and that sled took off, he forgot all about not having a good ride anymore. In fact, it got a little too good for him. Now, financially, generally, we don't have a problem having too good a ride. Do you ever hear somebody say, I have too much? In fact, it'd sort of be neat if I would have the ability, which I don't. I thought maybe I should just come and ask, who here would turn down $1 million? If I could just write you a check and say, anybody of you wants to come up, I'll write you $1 million check and you can walk out. Is there anybody smart enough here not to take it? You know, I would actually be dumb. If you have a hospital bill or something, it might be one thing, but otherwise it would ruin you. Guaranteed. We had close neighbors in Kentucky. They sued the doctor for malpractice. He seemed fine. I don't know what he did to him, but anyways. Got $1 million. You know, they were the... Did do him a bit of good. So let's think about exponential increase. So would you all agree that it's okay to have a house to live in, right? So if you have a family home, it's great to have a house. Sure glad that my dad had one and I'm all along with a house, living in a house. So next step, is it okay to buy the house you live in? That'd be sort of goofy to say you can live in a house and not buy it, right? So, okay, yeah, buy your house. No problem. What happens when you buy the house, even whether you rent it maybe? And by the way, does it mean just because I would say it's good to live in a house and it's okay to buy a house, does it mean everybody should buy a house? Potentially not. That's where we get wrong, friends, on this thing of finances. We like to apply a rule for everybody. It don't work that way. There's probably some people sitting here, it's better if you don't buy a house, even though it's not wrong. And I don't want to decide that for you, of course. But then you buy the house, now you got to decide what kind of furniture. So if you're poor, start out poor like we did, well, you buy what you can afford, or you buy one couch you can't afford, and then that's the only couch you have for 15 years. That's what I did, I guess. I don't know. But, you know, you keep... So, and then you have to decide what style of furniture should I buy? What kind of... Or do I just sit on the floor? You know, it goes on and on. If you want any kind of yard, Do I buy a lawnmower? What kind of lawnmower do I buy? Or do I just spray Roundup? If I spray Roundup, do I buy a sprayer? Do I buy an electric sprayer? Do I have a backpack sprayer? So eventually you get some of those minor questions settled in your mind. Now you're 10 years down the road and those trees are hard to keep up. My woods gets all brushy. It'd be awful nice to have a little tractor loader with a bush hog. So should I go buy a tractor loader bush hog? Is there anything wrong with that? Well, no. It's fine to have a tractor. But should everybody buy a tractor? Well, hard to think so. But still sure be handy. Okay, enough. You see how it increases. And then as I get the place paid for, as it gets, things become a little faster, I hit the skid trail part of this trail, that section of the trail. I'm like, oh, there's a little more money floating around here. So yeah, I've always wanted a tractor. Let's go buy it. I've wanted this, and so I go buy it. And pretty soon, I end up at a place I thought I would have told you 10 years ago I didn't want to go. How? Simply by following nature, if you will. We could do another question. Is it okay to go fishing? I hope so. If you don't think it is, you can come tell me. I know some of you don't like fishing. I'm not asking you that. I'm asking you if I may go fishing and still be a Christian. So let's say, oh yeah, Joe, you can fish occasionally and be a Christian. Good. So can a Christian have $100, $400 fishing pools? I say that's a bit excessive. Well, it wouldn't be that hard to get there, honestly. I mean, you could work on it, take a little while, but yeah, you can sort of get that slide going too. So do you understand what I'm saying? Is you start small, and yes, the thing is innocent, the thing is harmless, the thing is maybe even needful. 10, 20, 30, 40 years, we end up with this person with a huge accumulation, and then we have young people that look at this person with huge accumulation and think, I'd like to do that. Think about it. Here for myself, what deliberate steps and choices am I making today to guard against having too much? What deliberate steps and choices am I making today to guard against having too much? If I'm not making deliberate steps and choices in my life today, I don't care what your age is, you will end up with too many things in your life. I believe that. I don't know. You can argue if you want to, and I'll listen to you. I'm not going to argue. But I honestly believe that. Unless you are making choices and steps to keep from going there, you end up there. It's like that skid trail again. You're going to end up in a place because you get there. What deliberate steps and choices am I making today to ensure that my heart does not become set on things of this life and this world? What am I doing today? When I wake up in the morning, what steps am I going to take today to make sure that these things don't fasten a hold on me and drag me down? I have to think so much of the analogy of a runner. If you saw a runner trying to pull two suitcases and two carry-ons as he ran a race, you'd say, how dumb, right? But I think that's many times how Christians try to run the Christian race. Does it work? Okay, quotes from the brothers. They didn't seem to want to be named, so here we go. Materialism. He said, we gradually just accumulate more and more things, more and more money. This process brings with it a gradual but sure loss of focus. So that's not me talking. I guess at least one person has the same battle I do, huh? So what are you doing to mitigate or avoid this process? I want to read another quote here in a minute, but it brought me to this point, a cluttered life. Again, borrowing from Dr. Leslie, one of his patients told him, the more things you own, the more things own you. You follow that? The more fishing poles I buy, the more fishing poles I have to worry about, right? Simple. And you know, things accumulate so it's about impossible to shed all these things. I mean, you should just visit our home. Actually, please don't. But go in some of our bedrooms. The gifts that these children get. And you know, bless her heart, but the one daughter wanted to buy a watch. Well, I was okay with that, but guess what? Come to find out, her sister saved her watch box, so she had to save a watch box. I mean, who wants to be a slave to a little piece of cardboard cluttering up your room? Come on, somewhere we got to get rid of these things. We just can't have everything that's fun to have. And that's, I think, what's so unfortunate and so sad in our broader culture is all these people that have so much and yet have nothing. You know, sometimes less is more, for sure. What is in control of your life? What is really the master? Who is the slave? Okay, quoting the next brother. The pursuit of earthly things, of wealth, of an easy lifestyle, causes us to drift away from God. This is someone else talking again. Just keep that in mind. Our great successes in physical and financial areas have led us to have a lack of seeing our need to trust God. This self-sufficiency carries over to our spiritual lives far more than we realize. We would never think of saying we don't need God, but our actions indicate we do not see our need of Him. And that's quoting a brother here in church. Is he right? What deliberate steps or choices am I making today to guard against having too much? What deliberate steps or choices am I making today to ensure my heart does not become set on things of this life and this world? Finally, I'm going to have to say no to some things. Of what does your life consist? Does your walk match your talk? Remember, how much effort and work does it take to lose yourself? Basically, none at all. How much effort and work does it take to keep from getting lost in materialism? It takes continual effort, situational awareness, to keep from being lost. Too often, financial convictions change with the change in financial circumstances. The more things you own, the more things will own you, unless you're Christ. Holy. Let's kneel for prayer.